never know when the world that gonna beat for that beat.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Benjamin Mazzotta, who is a postdoctoral research fellow for inclusive growth at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He works on the cost of cash study, which shatters the myth that cash is free of cost, since virtually all economic actors pay direct and indirect financial burdens to participate in the cash payment system. Welcome to Background Briefing, Benjamin Mazzotta.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Ben, I wanted to get an idea of the percentage of U.S. $100 bills that circulate abroad now that the new bill is finally coming out on Tuesday.
This might be the most international currency since Roman times. It's thought that two-thirds of the U.S. money supply circulates overseas, and overwhelmingly so in the large denomination, the $100 bill.
And why is that?
Well, it's really difficult to find a global currency that's accepted by everyone and that stores enough value in it that it's easy to make a payment for a business-to-business transaction or for a person-to-person remittance. It's difficult to find a currency that everyone sort of expects will be worth what it was worth when you first got your hands on it, that won't erode in value over time. It's probably the most stable currency in the world as far as that is concerned. And as you well know, in international financial markets, a lot of transactions are denominated in U.S. dollars, for example, commodity transactions. And the same turns out to be true for person-to-person markets and business-to-business markets. It's easy to make a transaction in U.S. dollars if the counterparties don't share a currency in common.
But my understanding is, Ben Mazzotta, is that it is also the most counterfeited. The $100 bill is the most counterfeited bill in the planet.
Well, it might be the best target in the world for counterfeiting for reasons we've just gone over. It's actually not the most counterfeited, the U.S. dollar, I should say. I don't know about the $100 bill in particular, but the U.S. dollar is not the most counterfeited currency on the planet. There's a report by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis several years ago that suggests that the rate for the euro is around double what we see for U.S. counterfeit bills as far as the domestic circulation of bills. As far as what's circulating globally, I don't think there are accurate figures available on how many bad $100 bills are circulating worldwide.
Well, my understanding is, for example, before the Iranian Revolution, the Shah, who was basically, we were selling him anything and everything he wanted to print some new currency to celebrate the Peacock Throne, and we sold him the intaglio presses and the cotton paper that prints the bills. And estimates are after the revolution that Hezbollah got hold of these, or the Iranian revolutionaries moved them to the Bakr Valley, the printing presses, and they printed about $17 billion in U.S. $100 bills. And this is based on the estimates based on the amount of paper they had. So that's a big chunk. A lot of these counterfeit bills, by understanding, the counterfeit $100 bills have shown up in Russia. Is that your understanding?
I'm certainly not well-versed in the appearance of U.S. $100 bills in Russia, but from time to time, there indeed have been governments that have been accused of complicity in the printing of counterfeit U.S. money, most notably North Korea in recent years for printing letter-perfect copies of U.S. $100 bills. The availability of intaglio presses is absolutely one of the primary security features in deterring counterfeit attempts, as is the limited supply of secure paper for printing knockoffs of U.S. currency.
So, Ben, the reason I'm calling you is I wanted to get an idea from you about the reasons for this long and inordinate delay of the new $100 bill that finally comes out on Tuesday. And there are many, many parts of this story, some of which read like a Hollywood movie. Apparently, one of the first shipments of the printed bills from the Bureau of Engraving to the U.S. Mint was intercepted by thieves. Billions were stolen. Is that right?
Yes, there's definitely been news coverage about an intercepted shipment of the currency. So that absolutely has the feel of a Hollywood caper to it, sort of the stuff that you just couldn't write.
So as a result of that, they had to change the bills, didn't they? They had to change the colors and stuff?
I'm not aware, I have to say, of the specific relationship between choices about the colors of the bills and that theft itself. I wasn't aware that that was the reasoning for changes that may have been made partway through, but it sounds like you've been following it very closely.
So, Ben, now that we're finally going to get the new $100 bills and we understand how much has been counterfeited over the years and the theft of the first batch, etc., but hasn't there been a problem, you know, with this latest batch, this coming out on Tuesday, with the printing? What do you know about the screw-ups at the Bureau of Engraving?
Roughly what I understand is about the same as what you can gather if you really poke around on the web and read the news reports about it. My understanding of the major printing problems have had to do with the way that the papers reacted to the increased weight of the intaglio presses, and that the first batch had an indeterminate number of bills that had folded during the printing process, and therefore they had gaps in where the ink appeared on the paper. They had little blank spots, and that the newest batch has had some blotching, so there's been some extra ink in places where it shouldn't have shown up, and certainly the government is not ready to put into circulation bills that are anything less than letter perfect. If they're not absolutely accurate, the government won't put them into circulation. It'll just continue to use orders of existing designs from all the appropriate suppliers, because the last thing that you'd want to do is put into circulation a currency that's known to have sort of a production failure rate, because then all the counterfeiters would have to do is try to mimic somehow that they were some of the legitimate error rate in the production circulation. So as the bills are delivered from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to the Fed, they're checked. And if the error rate exceeds whatever the tolerances are, then they refuse to accept the bills and they send them back. And those can turn out to be some very, very impressive numbers in terms of the value of the currency that's returned if, in fact, the Fed can't accept them. And the Bureau of Engraving and Printing is on record as saying that they don't get paid unless they deliver product that the Fed can use. So really, this is just the same as having accountants do work that turns out later not to have the sums add up, or you know, or having a car put together that the wheels fall off. If the currency isn't printed accurately, it can't be used, and whatever resources have been sunk into the printing of that money are essentially lost.
And I presumably the bad bills are destroyed.
Yes, the bad bills absolutely are destroyed. There's no sort of secondhand market for near perfect. You can't go to Kmart and get them at a discount.
So it's not like collecting stamps, where flawed stamps have enormous value.
No, there is some suggestion that the polymer bills that are being created in other countries around the world might be recyclable in a way that the secure paper that's used for U.S. currency is not. But I think we'll see whether or not that has a real impact on the environment and on the finances of those governments in a few years' time.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Benjamin Mazzotta, who's a postdoctoral research fellow for inclusive growth at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He works on the cost of cash study, which shatters the myth that cash is free of cost, since virtually all economic actors pay direct and indirect financial burdens to participate in the cash payments system. And we've established that two-thirds of all $100 bills are circulated abroad, and we're talking about why it is that the new $100 bills have been delayed and delayed and delayed, and there are many reasons for it, some of which might well end up in a Hollywood movie. You mentioned, Ben, the polymer bills. Canadians have them. The Australians have had them for decades. My understanding is that they're harder to counterfeit. And talk about recycling. If you forget to put your money, take your money out of your pockets and wash your pants with Australian money, it's perfectly good. I mean, it comes out cleaner, but not damaged. Talk about money laundering.
I guess you could say that there, for the counterfeiters, there are ways of washing the dye off of U.S. currency in order to do some obscure step of a long counterfeit procedure that I certainly don't understand and wouldn't recommend that anybody experiment with at home. On the other hand, I can vouch as an American that I have put money through the laundry more than once, and I've never found it to be of noticeably substandard quality, but of course I don't sit on the other side of the ATM looking through the bills that I've that have come out of my wallet afterwards to know whether or not they get recirculated or sent on for destruction. The polymer bills do have a slightly longer life, and the first evidence from the Central Bank of Australia does, in fact, back this up, that the majority of notes that are passed, the vast majority of notes of counterfeit notes that are passed in Australia are indeed knockoffs of the pre-substrates, the pre-polymer bills, and not the current generation. So to the best of central bank research understanding, yes, it is more difficult to counterfeit the polymer bills, but they're certainly not immune. And you can find news stories on the web from the last couple of years from any number of countries that do have polymer or substrate currency, indicating that people are passing bad bills. And really, from the cashier's perspective, the trick is, how easy is it to tell that what's being passed to you is funny money? And so there's a number of tricks that are used by cashiers, not tricks, valid, reasonable tests to ensure that the currency is made of the correct paper, that it has the correct fibers in it, that it has all the modern security features that ought to be there.
So, Ben Masoda, why then does the Bureau of Engraving sort of stick to the old-fashioned methods if there are these new technological ways to make bills much more difficult to counterfeit? One of the excuses that I've heard is that the reason that they've, you know, stuck with the paper and the green ink is that the American people weren't ready for brightly colored different notes. Like almost every other currency in the world had different colors for different denominations, but we stick with the greenback no matter what the denomination is. A little bit of color started to creep in. So is the Bureau of Engraving just basically a conservative operation?
You know, it's funny how many things about money really respond to sort of what your expectations are and what you're used to. And that's a lot of what our research at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises covers. We try and estimate whether people are ready for change. The Central Bank of Australia has an entire study asking whether people learn from bank failures, whether they should switch over from keeping most of their money in the bank to some in a nice hard currency like the dollar or the euro, in addition to keeping some in the bank. And the evidence is that it's true, that people don't sort of gradually switch their behavior over time. They make these sudden changes. They learn in response to events. And then whatever patterns they have, they really like those patterns. So take the United States. You're self-employed. You're used to handling a lot of cash. It doesn't really seem out of place to you to have thousands and thousands of dollars in your house. You know, I don't want to speculate on the upper limits, but certainly, you know, more than $10,000 more than a comparable person who's not self-employed might just seem perfectly natural to you to keep in the house. A survivalist that keeps additional water and additional food in the basement might keep a ton of extra currency around just in case that blackout comes that makes it hard to get more money out of the bank or more money to send your payments to any old store where you might need to buy something or to pay your mortgage on time. So as far as what's the government's perspective on the color of money, I have to admit, as an American, when I saw that they were working purple into a $5 bill, I thought for the first time, it looked just kind of silly. And I don't think that that's a reason to make a national decision about anti-counterfeiting technology. But on the other hand, it's true that in other countries, we see all types of different substrate being developed and then used in currency design, different sizes of money to do everything from deter counterfeiting, but also to assist the visually impaired in identifying the denominations of bills that they're holding if their sight isn't up to 100%. So I think that all these choices are things that matter, and tradition is very important to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. They've deliberately gone with their preferred supplier, their trusted supplier of secure paper that preserves the correct look and feel of U.S. currency. And in fact, some of the finest counterfeits that have ever been passed, one of the ways that they were detected ultimately was because a trained currency specialist kept crinkling that funny money in his hands and decided that they just had the wrong look and feel. So they kept looking and they found other microscopic evidence that in fact the bills had not been printed on official U.S. government secure paper. And this is big, big business, just like you've pointed out. There's lots of people that would love to have a cheap Intaglio printing press, and they cost tens of millions of dollars to get your hands on just one. One of the reasons is to prevent people who would seek to dilute the money supply and thereby steal the value of honest savers like you and me, basically erode the value of all of our savings accounts by passing funny money. it's exactly a deterrent. Try and limit to the greatest extent you possibly can the number of people that have ever seen or know how to operate an Intaglio press, the number of people that have any access whatever to official U.S. government secure paper.
So, Ben Rizzotti, let's turn in the last few minutes then to the work that you do on the cost of cash. Now, there have often been suggestions that we should do away with cash. Where do we stand on that?
The cash industry, it really is an industry, and there's very few buyers in the currency market, but everybody's curious what's the demand for cash. There are lots of different payment instruments, and often we talk about cash just as if it were a payment instrument, because in the United States, it's really not the primary saving asset for most households. It's uncommon that you get your salary paid in cash if you had what we'll term a job in the formal sector. Maybe that's a little bit too technical for some of your listeners. But I think we all know what it means to get paid under the table. People who are working day jobs under the table, maybe they're getting paid from their employers directly in cash, but the rest of us aren't. We're mostly using it for small value payments. And so that's really the payment segment where I think people least expect cash to be displaced anytime soon. There have been technical solutions to this problem definitely around for 20, 30 years. It's possible to get an e-wallet that will make a peer-to-peer payment, small value amounts of money that run on different payment rails than your MasterCard, than your salary payment, than your online bill payments. These e-cash systems are there, and they just seem not to have taken. The demand isn't there for them to displace the very smallest value transactions, but it's a moving target. So, for example, the Philadelphia Transit System, the SEPTA, is now thinking about accepting credit card payments in lieu of something that we call in Boston the Charlie Card. That's our contactless subway fare system. They're saying that you might actually just be able to whip out a credit card instead of a subway card to pay your subway fare as you walk through. And there's been some important technical developments in how the payments are processed that permit that. The currency specialists will tell you that cash's share of payments may be eroding somewhat, but that its overall demand in the United States and in most rich markets is in fact growing over time. The rate of growth is certainly in question. And the place where you see the very highest levels of cash use, places like the countries that we study in our reports, so that's India, that's Mexico, that's Egypt, the reasons that cash use is so high there is because of the types of payments that it's being used for. It sounds crazy to a North American that you would go and pay every last bill for the month in cash, that if you owed the city some taxes, that if you wanted to pay your water bill, if you wanted to pay your mortgage, if you wanted to receive a salary payment, that those types of things would happen in cash. And yet there are an awful lot of those very large value payments from a retail perspective that are currently and traditionally made in cash in those economies. And so people need to keep a lot of cash on hand. These are also countries where not everybody has a bank account. In the United States, one of the things that our research shows is that people who don't have bank accounts pay a lot more for access to cash than people who do. It sounds funny. How can they need access to cash? Well, maybe their payments are coming as a paycheck or an electronic transfer, and they want to convert that into cash so they can go out and spend it. And those people who don't have bank accounts seem to pay the most, and they also pay the most often. They're the most likely ones to need to pay for access to cash when the payment instrument they get isn't the same as the payment instrument that they want to use later on. In India, for example, 2/3 of the population doesn't have a bank account. And of the people who have bank accounts, again, it's 3/4 of the bank accounts, roughly speaking, that are dormant, meaning that they haven't been used to make or receive a payment in the last year. So the vast majority of the population don't have bank accounts, and they're stuck doing everything in cash. So that's really where you'd see the most movement, the fastest, away from cash. And the poster child for that is Kenya. Kenya has seen rapid, rapid movement into mobile money in an economy where almost nobody had bank accounts.
Well, Dr. Benjamin Mazzotta, I thank you so much for joining us here. And I guess in closing, it doesn't look like the Bitcoin's going to take off, right? We're stuck with the greenback for a while, right?
Bitcoins are one of my favorite topics. Well, we'll have to spend another yarn about that some other time.
Okay. I appreciate you joining us.
thanks again for all your attention and your interest in our research, and I wish you very well.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Benjamin Mazzotta, who's a postdoctoral research fellow for inclusive growth at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He works on the cost of cash study, which shatters the myth that cash is free of cost, since virtually all economic actors pay direct and indirect financial burdens to participate in the cash payment system. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.